dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the show, we'll continue to explore visions of human society more congenial to our highest aspirations, as well as our most basic needs. In the first hour of the program, we'll return to another recording from the 4th Okanox Conference, Free Software and Beyond, the World of Peer Production, held in Manchester, England at the end of March. The talks from that conference I think are interesting as they attempt to grapple with current and future problems within the framework of a high-tech society, a much different view from the localized, power-down, agrarian vision conceptualized by many of the speakers I've presented. What is in fact possible, and over what time frame, I don't pretend to know. But the discussion of our first speaker, Smári McCarthy of Iceland, deals with changes within a contemporary setting. His talk is titled The End of Artificial Scarcity, The Failures of the Materials Economy and How We Fix Them. In it, he examines the functional model of our society and how subtle changes to its underlying principles can alter it significantly. He asks, are the assumptions we make often unknowingly correct? And if not, why are they so readily accepted? And what can be done to change that? He proposes alternatives inspired by peer-to-peer philosophy that provide a roadmap toward a new economic model as well as a new system of law and governance. Last week, I read you an essay by Charles Eisenstein that also grappled with the problem of the competitive and exploitative worldview that poisons our interactions with each other and the natural world. It so inspired me that I sought out more of his writing, and I'll read some of that to you in the second hour. So let's begin with Smári McCarthy.
I kind of like to say that my life has been a bit of a duality for the last couple of years. I've been, on the one hand, working on highly technical things, and on the other hand, working on highly political things. You can guess which one represents which. But essentially, it's a very long, complex tale of interconnections through various projects, and it just gets more complicated every day. But essentially, what it started out as is, I kind of like got into the entire free software movement about a decade ago, and got like really interested in how software works and that kind of thing. And the more I learned about it, the more I got involved in this entire freedom debate. And I always like this quote because it kind of explains more or less everything that what I'm working on represents. And of course, I had to put this one here because we're in England. I really don't like this kind of thing. But the thing is, the entire battle for freedoms and all that is it's always a long and bloody battle. There's some of them are more famous than others. This is from Chicago, the Haymarket Massacre. And it seems that, when I was working on the entire free software thing, I was completely oblivious to the fact that really the freedoms are not as easily defined as free software people like to think. And I mean, this one is from Iceland. This is the first occasion of two that tear gas was used in Iceland. The second occasion was about a month or two ago, just before our government collapsed. So, you know, through this entire thing, I got into realizing that the more technologically advanced we get as a culture, the more our physical freedoms, in the sense of what we can say politically, what we can do within our base systems, they're all always hinging more and more on the freedoms we have in the digital realm. So the question came up, how do we push all of that stuff down into the physical world, all the stuff that we've been doing in cyberspace for a couple of decades and doing pretty well with? Because free software is a very solved problem. We know how to do it. We've got really smart models. Yes, there's still a lot to research in that field, but you know, the more we get into the physical realm, the less freedoms we really have. So I got involved in this Fab Lab thing, which is all about taking the entire concept of manufacturing and pushing it down into the level where individuals could participate. And it kind of, like that there picture is the total idea. You kind of just design something, you code it, you print it. And I often joke that my work in that field is done when I can download a chicken sandwich off the internet. So so to explain the picture here, one of the more interesting projects that has happened was in the north of Norway, somebody decided to build GSM phones for sheep just that hang around their necks and transmit so they can call up the sheep and get GPS information about them. And there's been all sorts of similar projects. You know, you have to ask these questions like what happens if the molecular assembler, the perfect molecular disassembly device, comes into existence tomorrow? How will society react to that? Will people in general be able to handle that kind of transformation? I mean, what happens if some company comes up with a technology and patents it and says, no, we're not going to share the technology with anyone, we're just going to, you know, have a monopoly on making everything for a couple of years, you know? And that kind of thought is very scary. So the entire Fab Lab concept is, to me, it's kind of just making sure that by the time this technology appears, everybody will know exactly how it works. And that's a very important thing. So this is a open source design of a CNC mill that we were playing around with a while ago. Martin's not here. No, okay. And this here is a project we were doing in Afghanistan a couple of months ago, well, in January. I kind of missed the Icelandic Revolution because I was doing this. And to explain, these are directional parabolic antennas built out of plywood and chicken wire mesh. It's as cheap and simple as you can possibly make it. And we're spanning 4 kilometer links with chicken wire mesh. It's completely insane. And what we did during the course of 2 weeks was, with 7 people, we kind of just carpeted an entire city with free wireless internet. And for that, for about $40,000, including our flights, which were the most expensive part, the food, the hosting, etc. So with that thing, we showed not only our Fab Labs actually capable of doing cool things, but they are also capable of doing them far better than the aid agencies, etc., that have been sitting with hundreds of employees for years with nearly unlimited budgets. Yeah. They haven't, to my mind, had any really cool success stories like this. But this entire thing just, you know, the more I got into this entire debate, the more I learned that at the end of the day, it isn't about really cool technologies, about being able to print out stuff. Because, you know, being able to print out chicken sandwiches won't change who we are as people. Like, society has chicken sandwiches, they know what they do for us. So I kind of got into reading all the old literature, and it turns out that all the really cool ideas that are coming out, they're all 200 years old. We're not inventing anything, we're just implementing it. And, you know, so you had to start, I had to start asking questions about food. And it came down to the point where I was faced with two underlying assumptions that are basically underlying everything in society. Every single thing in the way societies function nowadays are based on two lies. And I call them lies because I think that they, I mean, they may have been well-intentioned originally, but they are very, they've become such an integral part of how society is defined that they have the same effect. And on the one hand, there's Hobbes' lie, which narrowly, you know, really condensed, is without a strong centralized government, humanity will essentially go into chaos, a bellum omnium contra omnes, war of all against all, and we will all die. I kind of don't really believe that's going to happen, and you know, the fact that we have the free software movement at all, you know, kind of points out that that isn't the case. The other lie is that without a strong centralized government or some sort of method of restricting the access to resources, then people will use them all, finish them, and then we'll all starve to death. You know, so either way we die. And of course, Christian mentioned in his last thing Gerd Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, which is essentially a modernization of that lie. And now, of course, the fact that I'm saying that these are lies kind of needs some sort of justification. So I'm going to cite a few statistics. The first statistic is food, because food is something we all need and that kind of thing. So according to the United States Agricultural agency, the annual produce of vegetables worldwide is about 6.2 billion tons, metric tons. And the average consumption of food of a American is 884 kilos of food a year. So if you divide that, you'll see that there's more vegetables than all of humanity needs to sustain themselves. And we haven't even counted meat, fish, dairy products, eggs, you know, that kind of thing. Yes, a lot of the vegetable produce goes into raising animals and stuff, but you know, at the end of the day, food does not appear to be scarce. And what more, about 2/3 of all food that's produced in the world is thrown away every year. That's and you know, if anybody's ever gone dumpster diving, then you'll understand what I mean. It's not just that the production point where the farmers are throwing away stuff, for example in the United States, where they just get paid more money for producing less stuff, but also in supermarkets where they find one rotten apple and just say, okay, there might be more rotten apples statistically, so let's throw the entire batch out. And it just doesn't really make sense. You can go through similar statistics with building supplies, with concrete, with wood. There are definitely some kinds of wood, like mahogany, that are becoming endangered and so on. But what it all comes down to is the fact that there's currently about 80 million people who are below the hunger threshold. There are about another 8 million that are in subprime living conditions, like don't have roofs over their heads or whatever. And none of this needs to be the case. And, well, there's basically the problem is distribution systems, and both Karl Marx and Adam Smith and all these other theorists wrote extensively about how the entire distribution problem was the only remaining problem in their ideal models. So, I often mention veganism, this is a two-part dumpster diving, as the perfect social phenotype for there being abundance. That is to say, there's so much stuff that we don't even need to work, we can just go out and dumpster dive for it, you know. So we kind of need to define scarcity, and I ventured on this kind of definition that you may or may not agree with, but the method of this definition is to say, can it be depleted sensibly? Or that is to say, if we use it sensibly, can it be depleted? And then, alternatively, the concept of rivalry. Does the use of anything preclude the use of others of the same thing, which for free software, for example, or software in general, software is not rival. Anybody can copy it. Whereas this chair here, it's quite rival. You know, if I sit in it, you can't. Ha! And I kind of put up this little, two-dimensional graph where I kind of put in loads of concepts that, you know, some are rival, some are not, some are scarce, some are not. And, there are some things that are inherently scarce. The Eiffel Tower is inherently scarce. There will always be one Eiffel Tower. You cannot copy it. If you copy it, it isn't the Eiffel Tower, it's just copy. You know, that's just because it's defined socially, through its history and its what it is. And the same goes for 15th century manuscripts. If you make a new one, it isn't 15th century, it's just a replica. You know? So, on the other hand, there's a bunch of stuff that isn't scarce. Music isn't really scarce. None of us can ever sit down and listen to all the music that's ever been produced. But on the other hand, you could say that good music is scarce. Okay. So, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to this. And you know, when dealing with this kind of thing, I kind of got challenged with, how do we fix it? How do we break the assumptions of Malthus's lie, of Hobbes' lie, break all this weird stuff that's going on? And Gini coefficient, for those who don't know, is a measure of relative inequality, while Human Development Index says whether or not you're going to have food on the table. And the story so far is essentially that its scarcity is artificially maintained. We know that there isn't any scarcity. It has been measured. Regarding the agriculture thing again, a paper by Perfecto et al. Showed that you could easily quadruple the world agricultural output, that's vegetables and beans and so on, by just switching to organic fertilizers. Something that, you know, seems so obvious that nobody has ever tried it. Or very few, and they're normally called clerks, crazy people. So, you know, we're involved in this entire social movement where we want more freedom from oppression, we want more freedom to do whatever we want, and everything in between. And it's kind of like a stack of freedoms, where at the bottom you've got the freedom to exist, the freedom to have physical form, freedom to radiate electromagnetic radiation into the atmosphere or environment. And, you know, the higher up you go, you get into more abstract things for example, the freedom of speech, which is very abstract. You know, it's something that you need to be a very high-level organism to be able to comprehend what it is, let alone have it. So, consumerism trashing our planet, economical underpinnings are relying on continued subservience, and we all want to make this new industry 2.0, where we redesign the industrial revolution to service the needs of those who actually need it, as opposed to the companies that have, had a really great time for the last 200-300 years just using us. And there's a guy that came up with this term, non-exotic objects, as to say, exotic objects are things the Eiffel Tower that are always scarce. And it came down to a couple of things. I kind of mapped out nine origin points of what needs to change if we want to change the entire distribution of goods, if we want to level out the distribution of wealth. And the first thing that came to me one night was that the law is essentially a social software project. It's code, legal code that's running on top of society, and anybody could essentially change it, but no, it, even though it exists in the public domain, as to say the law is freely copyable, etc., it's developed by a committee, and the committee decides what gets to be in there. And it's also self-modifying code. That is to say, every time something changes in the running of the society, some back effect or rebound effect from the parliamentarians or the whatever causes the code to change. And laws take effect, they start running on top of society. We kind of can't really do much if the law turns out to be really bad. So modern democracy... Oh, I forgot to translate that one, sorry. To translate modern democracy, at the top you have a legislative parliament, below it you have political parties, and then way below them you have people at varying degrees, depending on how important they are. And, you know, we kind of have to ask, can we do this better? Well, the internet already has, with mass media and production and, knowledge. Sorry, I'm going fast. I mean, we've already democratized mass media. We've already democratized production. We've democratized knowledge. So when are we going to democratize democracy? Okay. Well, it's a nice idea. It doesn't work, right? Never mind Twitch. So this is what people have been saying. Like, direct democracy, it just doesn't work. And people can't keep up with every issue, unless they're parliamentarians, but they're special somehow. I really don't understand this logic, but, you know, I'm willing to, you know, say, okay, you know, you might be right, so let's find some middle way, some middle ground. And when you go to vote, when you're participating in an election, you have two options. You have the option to participate, select yes or no. You have the option to abstain, as in, you know, put in black vote or just not show up. And, you know, what happens if we add the third option? Proxy. Allow somebody else to vote for us. Like, just say, I don't know about this issue. I just don't know what to do. So what happens if I give it to you? You know, I could do it generally. I could say, I'm apolitical, but, you know, you're a nice guy. I trust your opinions. We could also do it categorically. I don't know anything about agriculture or health services or whatever. Yeah. But I kind of trust you, you know. Or you could do it on a per-issue basis. Sorry, I'm really busy, can't get myself into this, but, you know, I feel this is an important thing and I kind of trust your judgment on this. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about, because when we're electing representatives in a representative government, what we're trusting is not their ability to make the right choice, but their ability... We're trusting in their judgment. We're trusting that, overall, they will most often take the right choice. And, of course... What happens is that if anybody's been drawing a picture, it turns out that this is a directed acyclic graph. That is to say, you've got loads of nodes which are people, and some of them are voting directly, and the other ones are creating edges between themselves, saying, "I'm going to, you know, go, you know, trust this guy." And every single form of government we've ever seen in the history of the planet exists as a possible state in this system. And we also get a load of really new and freaky ones that never would have made sense as political doctrines, but the most easy one is the dictatorship. Everybody forwards their vote to one person. Never mind why they would do that. Some people are crazy. The less obvious one is the representative democracy, which, you know, judging by this, turns out to be some sort of highly advanced form of dictatorship. You've got, sorry about that. because even though people are voting for different parliamentarians, then at the end of the election, once the votes have been tallied and the people get their seats, then you've got essentially a mapping from voters to votees, or, you know, from people who are casting the vote to the people who are going to make the decisions. So. This here is the case study of Iceland, a representative democracy with 63 parliamentarians. Yeah, I mean, is that necessarily better than what about this? It looks a bit mad, doesn't it? It's a kind of ad-hocracy. It's you've got people that are voting, you've got people who aren't, you've got people who are forwarding their votes to each other. It seems a bit crazy until you start asking questions about the structure. Now, I made a mistake in this one. Do you see it? That could never really happen. And, you know, if we were to imagine this as a software system, then once somebody creates a loop, then they would get a warning like, you created a loop! Please destroy the loop. And, you know, of course they will. So, You know, somebody will have to destroy the loop, otherwise all of the members of the loop are essentially abstaining from voting. And these people here, they're the people who are making the decisions in the system. They're the people who are making the end final calls of what gets to be the law. And once you have this kind of system, you need to be able to change your mind. It's very natural to change your mind. I mean, I do it all the time. I've done it 3 times today. And, you know, the modern democratic systems, they assume that you can't change your mind. Once you put your vote into the ballot box, you cannot change your mind anymore. It's just fixed. Because, you know, they're not going to let you go fishing after you vote to change it and whatnot. And, you know, it's just technically not possible today. But with strong public key cryptography, we can actually do it. It's like the technology for doing this exists. We can say, you know, I'm going to vote on this issue. No, I've changed my mind. Okay, I'm changing it back. You know, you can do it as often as you like. And by allowing people to do this, you get a lot of free features. The first one is that you can no longer force opinions on people. As I say, I cannot come up to Martin with a gun and say, you are going to vote for this. Because, you know, as soon as I leave, you know, he'll change his mind. The second thing is that changes in trust lead to changes in structure. If I suddenly stop trusting the person that I'm proxying to, the entire structure changes, and suddenly the entire format of how the law came into effect changes with it. The third thing, which I think is more important, and it's kind of the meta thing with this, it's democracy evolves over time. We've got ourselves locked into this idea where democracy is just something that's really fixed, really well-defined, and, you know, if it's broken, then so what? But, you know, by allowing democracy to evolve, we gain a lot of leeway. And this has already been made. Thing is, I started throwing this idea around with a couple of friends back in October when the Icelandic economy went boom, and it turned out that two separate groups went off into separate directions and wrote code, and now we've got this website, direct.democracy.is, that is implementing all of the features of this democratic system that I've already mentioned. It's currently taking like a live feed off the actual Parliament website, dumping them into categories, trying to line everything up. We've even got video feeds going, and you know, it's really, really cool. And people can actually participate. It's all in Icelandic, but, you know, whatever. But there are many questions in this. Like, okay, if we're taking just from the Parliament, who gets to make motions? Is it just the parliamentarians, as it is in most countries? Well, why not everybody? What happens if we let everybody raise a motion? Legal code becomes like a wiki. We get all the features of a wiki where the official version is just decided by the votes. And it becomes a free market of motions, and everybody loves free markets, right? You know, everybody can participate in making a motion and just throwing it out there and seeing what happens. And then there's a popularity roundup. We get like a Reddit-style thing where the really, really cool motions bubble up to the top and the bad ones just lie down there somewhere. And, you know, how long do motions stay open? Why need we put arbitrary limits? We can change our votes whenever. So, like, how about when motions have enough support, they become the law? If the support wanes, you know, then they just stop being the law. And you can put all sorts of dampening rules that make sure that laws don't fluctuate in and out, but I don't really think they're necessary because, you know, if you've got 63 people that are voting, then sure, one person might change his mind every other day. But if you've got, like, a few million, chances of strong polarization are very, very low and might actually hint at some bigger problem. Like, I would love to see this kind of law go through in Israel, Palestine. So who can vote? Why need we say, oh, you have to be 18? Because I've never met anybody who's 18 and politically thinking who wasn't politically thinking at 17, right? Any arbitrary limitation is going to damage the entire interaction of the system. So, you know, we can discuss at length whether children have the right to have opinions. I think they do, but, you know, most people might disagree with me. But the important thing is, when people die, why should they have a vote? Why should dead people be able to say anything like this? The oldest law in effect in Iceland right now is from the year 1275. Right? No living Icelander, I hope, has agreed to this law. I mean, I did a recent poll. I was giving a talk last weekend and, you know, asked people there, are you, you know, in support of this law if it were a motion today? And nobody raised their hand. Maybe they were just shy, but, you know. But the fact is that most people don't know what the law says, and it's actually just two articles talking about the rights of churches to own land. So, you know, why should churches own land? Okay, never mind. What we're gaining from all this is a more responsive society. And, you know, it's the thing that's been going on for century after century after century is that the plutocrats and bureaucrats kind of, you know, they need us to not understand what the law is saying. They need us to you know, not know that there is a law. You know, they need to control the flow of information. And we as free software, free hardware, free anything enthusiasts, free culture enthusiasts, say, no, that's not going to work anymore. Sorry, you know, that day is over. People need to be informed about what the laws are. And, you know, if they are, they might actually abide by them. You know, there's a big question that always comes up, whether or not this kind of system will lead to a minimalist or maximalist kind of legal framework. I kind of tend towards thinking that it will be minimalist because, you know, there's going to be that few things that everybody can agree on, but those things are actually really, really good. But that kind of thing just isn't enough. Oh, yeah, then there's the fork motions. Anybody who's worked on free software with people who are very easy at disagreeing, you know, projects fork. Why can't countries fork? I mean, it might sound crazy, but if people have diverging attitudes towards certain issues, why don't they just break up, settle, you know, settle their differences, go somewhere else?
And South Ossetia, isn't it?
Yeah, South Ossetia is a great example, and there are many, many good examples.
It's not South Ossetia is not a good example at all. It's a strife. It's conflict.
Yes. Why it won't happen? It doesn't happen. It's an example of the problem.
It's a problem that can't be resolved democratically, and obviously not by military means. So, you know, it just gets, you know, dumbed down every now and then. So
what is your solution to South Ossetia?
Allow people to make up their own mind and.
No, there are those people, they do make up their minds. They want to go into different directions. One wants to stay and the other one wants to go.
And why don't
so there's no solution. There's no solution.
Sure. Yeah, for example, like the rich don't want to carry the burden of the poor.
Okay, a better example.
It's a question of hegemony in the system as well, because if the United States doesn't support it and supports Georgia, and then Russia supports it, but then the United States is more powerful, it's a war system problem as well.
A better example would be Flanders and Wallonia in Belgium.
Yeah, but that is a fit. This example is fit to your purpose. But Ossetia doesn't work.
As an example of problem that exists with countries that want to leave and they can't leave because the system, the way it is now, won't let them go.
The borders are too strictly defined.
South Ossetia, Transnistria, there's lots of countries.
It's not a country because there are Georgians in South Ossetia and South Ossetians in South Ossetia.
It was
the
same in Kosovo,
but it happened.
The other one wanted to go. It was the same in Kosovo, but it did happen for certain reasons, didn't it? So if
but it's not just. It's quite clear that
it's
geopolitics 101. You know, people will not agree on this. If you were voting now, you'd probably vote differently. You know, opposing on this issue. Once we've democratized democracy, big challenge. You know, nobody's going to agree with me on this. What happens if we democratize money? Now, what do we mean when we say democratize money? Well, we need to understand what money is, and, you know, everybody's seen that Zeitgeist movie, but, you know, the fact is that money is very strictly centralized today. There's the way money is defined is a very centralized thing, and we have a very cool means of decentralizing it. It's called PGP. You might have heard of it. But money has a few features, and this is from The Future of Money by Bernard Leiter. So the first feature is it's geographically defined. Separate countries have separate currencies. This is partially used as a method of creating nationalism, withholding the group unity, and also trade as a like very simplified form of trade restriction, just to keep goods from traveling over borders without the government getting a chance to put its finger in. And second is that money is created from nothing. This used to be not the case when we had a gold standard and all that stuff, but today money is literally made out of nothing. And I actually think that this is a good thing, because gold is inherently scarce. Like, there's only so many gold atoms on the planet, right? And besides, if you bind the value of money to a certain commodity, be it gold or rice or, you know, whatever, concrete, we are always going to have people trying to control that substance. So, like, the De Beers Consolidated Mines have the diamond industry completely enthralled. So they control the price of diamonds. And if money were bound to diamonds, then, you know, they would control money as well. But money is created through loans. People take bank loans, but essentially when banks are loaning other banks, and especially central banks are loaning money to the other banks, that is when money is created. That's like the moment of ignition. And that there is the key point, coupled with this one here, the fact that interest is paid on any debt. So when I get a loan, I actually have to pay more money back, which means that, well, can we do the math on this? Like, if there's only £10 existent in the entire system and I borrow it from somebody and they insist that I pay £10.50 back, how am I going to do that? There's no more money in the system, so we always need to create more and more money to solve it. And this is actually what we call a non-zero-sum game, as in you cannot at any point in time say, okay, let's just sum up all the credit and the debit and, you know, get a zero, because, you know, we'll always get a huge negative number, and that negative number increases all the time. Negative if you do it one way, positive if you do it the other, never mind. The point is that having a zero-sum game for money would be better. And so how about we change it? How about if Alice wants to buy something from Bob, Alice takes a piece of paper and writes £10 on it, you know, that's the amount, and then she digitally signs it, and then she encrypts that thing and sends it to Bob. And then Bob wants to buy something from Charles and, you know, does exactly the same thing, digitally signs a agreement saying that that he owes Charles £12, and then, you know, Charles might owe Alice £9, and then we resolve the system by everybody just unencrypting the financial statements, essentially, and the entire thing gets zeroed out to the maximum extent possible. Now, of course, this is a very, very simple example. If you were to take the entire network, say the entire network of voters that we had earlier, and just run it through the entire thing, it's a n log n problem if you're into algorithms, then you can actually resolve the entire monetary system at the blink of an eye.
All right, how about meaning of if someone gets for a service, for example, I get from Bob, he served me something, and I say I gave 10 euros for it. Yeah. And Charles think, okay, this thing he served to me is, for me, it's not, it's, I need
12
euros or 8 euros. This thing,
well,
the system.
The thing is, this.
Different views, of course.
Yeah, definitely. This thing doesn't aim at equality, really. This is just a measure of how to trade goods, because people today think that we need a monetary system in order to do things. You know, I kind of don't agree, but since everybody believes it, then, you know, let's give them one that kind of works. At least one that works better than the current model.
Is there a software inside who can manage this
company? Oh yeah, there exists a couple of projects. The best one, to my mind, is DFUN. It's not working anymore. The guy who was writing it kind of just said, I've got other projects. But I can dig up the name of it later. I kind of can't remember. But you can do all of this just using PGP signatures and a bit of code in between. And the encryption part, I only stick that in there because did you notice the fact that if you encrypt every single financial transaction, then there is no way that any government can taxate you, right? And taxation is the foundation of government. If there is no taxes, then there is no government. But okay, so you know that's basically how this works. And okay, so that's kind of like two of the nine ideas. That's the monetary system, that's a democratic system. We still need to deal with a bunch of stuff. One of the great things is, like, the monetary system is different from the economy. The economy, well, especially the materials economy, which is kind of what the entire talk was supposed to be about originally. Sorry, I kind of broke that idea. The materials economy question, or, like, how things flow between each other, there was somebody who mentioned it during the first session, the work of Stafford Beer. Who's familiar with him? Yeah, it was you, yeah. Okay, Stafford Beer was, I think he was from Manchester, in fact. He was a cyberneticist back in the 70s, and very long after that. And in 1971, he was hired by Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, to go to Chile and build what would essentially be called the internet today. It was a long link of teletype machines connected through the phone lines that were supposed to take statistical information from the companies, from the mines, from everywhere where things are being produced, push it back and forth. Actually, it was very hierarchical the way they organized it. There was this big data center in Santiago that was supposed to deal with all the statistical output. But this system called CyberSyn, there's actually this really, really great talk he gave in 1972 when the project was alive and well and really doing some awesome stuff. And then in 1973, on the 11th of September, actually, oddly enough, the CIA sponsored Augusto Pinochet to assassinate Allende and take over the country of Chile, with the effect, which might not have been obvious at the time to, you know, the people who weren't paying attention, that CyberSyn was killed. And CyberSyn was essentially the internet. It was not the internet as we know it today, but it was a market economy. It was like the entire data stream of the economy pushed into cyberspace. And, you know, the reason that the kind of reason that's normally speculated why CIA sponsored this is that they wanted to keep the world price of copper down, because Chile produces most of the copper in the world, and you know, any sort of high-level, high-tech information system that would, you know, alert workers on how royally they're being screwed would definitely change the world price of copper. So you could say that the CIA killed the internet in order to save the internet. I don't know. So, like, that there is essentially just a plug-in solution to the economic problem. Because we have the internet, all we need to do is find some way of regulating or organizing all the information and put it out there. And when you take that coupled with a peer-to-peer distributed mutualist monetary system, and, you know, stick it in with a democracy where people actually have something to say, then we get a lot of things. So I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Most of this work is actually being done to some extent. Those are my nine little things. Each of them exists in a kind of separate vacuum at the moment, but you know, I've been trying to push so that they all work together in some way. And at the core of it is the identity infrastructure, which for people in like first world countries, we kind of don't recognize the importance of that kind of infrastructure. It kind of just like, we have good databases that take care of us. We don't need a better system. But by completely using the Ubuntu philosophy, saying that I am who I am because of who you all are, then I can be defined. My existence can be defined not by some centralized database run by the government, but by you guys, by you pledging for me essentially, and I for you similarly. And, you know, all of these things, they're really cool. So I'm just going to end up by pointing out a few books. I kind of missed a lot of really good ones, but, you know. yeah, it'll give you something to think about. And any questions?
I have one. It's really a question. How would you solve the following problem? In the Netherlands, we talked about it already.
Yeah.
We have an airport. There are people living around the airport. And if you expand the airport, there's a group, a small number of people that is going to be, that have to move or something.
Mm-hmm.
How does your system solve this? Well, it is a problem, because there's a small number of people that will vote against this, probably, mm-hmm. themselves.
Yeah.
But a large number of people say, I want the airport. It's not in my backyard issue.
Yeah, definitely.
How would your system solve this? Or
well, my system doesn't solve it.
No.
That's the truth. And it doesn't really have to, because people are supposed to solve it. This entire thing is about people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And you know, all I'm trying to do is improve the infrastructure so that people can solve things better.
Aren't you afraid that the democracy as it is in place now, at least in the Netherlands, I don't really know in the other countries, if you would transfer it to something more of this, that it would
you're worried about mob rule,
more a populist thing.
The
large amount of people would decide for.
Yeah.
The small amount of, if we all decide together,
exactly.
The Jews should be dead. Have a real extreme one. It could be done.
Definitely, definitely those things worry me. But the point about the Jews being dead, Hitler was never actually popularly voted. He was a minority.
He had a majority. He was
selected by Reichstag.
A genuine democratic majority.
Oh, well, okay, never mind,
So please get your history right.
Yeah, no, I have this from fairly good references, but never mind. Yeah.
That's a matter of fact. There is some truth to that.
Yeah.
Might be some place in the internet where it arrives differently,
mm-hmm.
but according to my standards of truth, it is important that Hitler was elected by the majority of German people, and there is no discussion about this.
Well, left.
What?
A big split on the left.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
The
point is.
It's about your scarcity. Space, for example.
Yeah, space is scarce. And, there is the option of the fork motions. The people who live on land can just say, we're not going to participate in this anymore, we're going to leave.
Yeah.
And, then it comes down to questions of human rights. Do we have the right to make new states? Do we have the right to not be invaded if we decide that Schiphol Airport is going to be our new city,
So you have to find the land to live on, actually.
Yeah.
One of the
I'm trying to resist my own trend to discard a lot of what you have proposed based on some things that I find inconsistent with my vision of a reality, because I think it would be a wrong attitude, because you are asked, I find some of the questions you're asking deeply right,
mm-hmm.
The question about democratizing democracy. I think this is a true question.
Mm-hmm.
I have my doubts about the answer you bring. But what strikes me is you have really a focus on an ideal system.
Yes.
Which means that things like transition issues or intermediate stage when you are poor, for example, you have everyone can change his words all the time. It's a paradise of spin doctors.
Or
things like that. This are not taken in account. So there is a kind of something which is, I have a respect for complexity, and I feel hurt by the fact that by looking only at projecting the idea, you do not take in account the complexity of the present.
Definitely. The entire media thing, how do we make sure that it doesn't become a media frenzy and the democracy be...
That's one example of all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely questions that need to be tackled. I think that, with the further democratization of the other stuff, the production, the media, all of these foundations, this thing will become less and less of a threat. Like, you know, while there's still people who are controlling the means of information flow, then, you know, any sort of idea like this is very prone to issues.
Let's say, to be more constructive, okay, when people started to argue for universal vote, the opponents say, you know, these are damn idiots and they don't know even how to read them. And there was a conscious decision not to wait, and to put in place at the same time some processes for people to become more educated and know to read, and the universal vote, and not to wait till... So I understand that, but you can have strategies like that where you make bets, but you don't wait for people to be perfect because before you make a system that builds on that.
Exactly.
But that was because you were not doing that for everything at the same time.
The thing that was hidden here was that there are transitional stages. Kind of hinted at it with the website democracy.is, which kind of works as a kind of transition. Essentially, what's happening now is people are slowly hearing about it, and, you know, going in and placing their vote, and, you know, we're doing all sorts of stuff to fix it into social networking, so it'll be a Facebook application and whatnot. And hopefully, at some point, we'll have enough mass behind it that one of two things will happen. Either parliamentarians will start doing exactly what is said on there, in which case they're proving themselves obsolete, or they will consciously decide to ignore it, in which case they're proving themselves to be at contrast with the general populace. Either way, they kind of shoot themselves.
What if they copy it?
What?
What if they copy it or they try to co-opt it and make their own government?
Well, they will. They will. We'll probably have to deal with it.
Let me take up an innocent example, the example of the voting age.
Okay.
I mean, your point, I'm sympathized with your point. Your point, of course, is well taken, that arbitrarily putting the voting age at 18 years is not as specific as you would like to. Now, on the other hand, if you are 2 or 3 or 4 years, what you are going to do is do exactly what your parents told you to do. Now, and there is just no way...
I know lots of 25-year-olds who do that.
But there is just no way to, in any detail, to determine at which particular time a child would be autonomous enough so that it could vote. Now, this is an impossible problem, and the way the society dealt with it is to have an arbitrary, an arbitrary limit. Now, what any relaxation of this arbitrary limit, say to in Reykjavik, they are allowed to do it with 7, whereas in Copenhagen or whatever, they are allowed to do it with 7.5. That's just the same arbitrary.
Definitely. Which one option for that?
I don't know any other.
We're running out of time, actually. As I understand.
Can I say something to this? You are totally right, but you could consider it as a set of experiments. So the information coming out of such limited arbitrary decisions might be very valuable for the whole global system. We might discover what works and what doesn't work.
Yes.
I think that your positions... There's two differentiations I would like to make. One is between abundance and scarcity, and one is about micro and macro. Right?
Okay.
So, for example, whenever something is abundant, then there's actually no problem with applying some of your ideas because you're not hurting anybody else. A good example is in free software. As long as we're making the free software, we have a self-regulating community, but when we're talking about the servers that are needed, then we have foundations that are democratically regulated, because it affects the whole community. And so the problem in Georgia or in South Asia is confusion of scarcity and abundance, because political power is related to scarce resources, so nobody wants to give them up. If you could split up and say, for example, say we can have cultural autonomy and that wouldn't affect the political, then people wouldn't be afraid to give them autonomy because, so we have to learn to distinguish between fields of scarcity and abundance and modulate, because it's polarity, there's no way to distinguish, so there's kind of hybrid things between.
Yeah.
And the other thing is between micro and micro, what I think what you're doing, this is very useful, is as communities of people who want to be autonomous,
mm-hmm.
like we want as much as we can control our destinies, and therefore we hack whatever we can, which is democracy, money, etc.
Yeah.
But we apply this in our own communities first.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay.
And
if it works, then we can talk to the macro society and say, well, if you try this out, this might work for you, right?
Yes.
But we shouldn't dream that we can, like wildly say, let's have this kind of voting system or monetary system. But first of all, because we don't have the power. And secondly, because you don't know all the possible negative consequences that
mm-hmm.
we may have. So we need to try it first ourselves.
Yeah.
And have monetary systems that work within our community.
Or non-monetary systems.
Or non-monetary systems, we can have...
Out
of the experience, we can talk in terms of policy to the macro society.
In terms of scale, there's a few really neat sociological and mathematical principles at work. One is Dunbar's law, or Dunbar's number, from Robin Dunbar, an anthropologist who said that human societies are essentially limited to 150 people, or that's like the tribal community. Once they grow bigger than that, then the interrelationships between any given pair of people is just unmanageable. And by way of Metcalfe's law, you've got 150 people turns out to be about 11,175 connections between pairs. And come on, who's going to be able to manage that? There's those two laws. There's Metcalfe's law, there's Dunbar's law. And then you've got the other two, which are essentially the 6 degrees of separation on one hand and then that thing on the other. The thing that I was talking with Martin about earlier, which was that in any system, a system is called self-organizing if redundancy increases over time. And redundancy is defined as 1 minus the entropy divided by the maximum possible entropy in the system. So the more redundant a system becomes, the more slack it has, the more capability it has to deal with new experiments.
Okay.
Sorry. Oh.
I agree with a lot of what you've said. One thing that I thought was maybe missing, and I'm going to sort of center that, is the whole issue of peak oil. And we're actually, we've actually got, all the industrial society has been built on the large availability of fossil fuels. It looks very likely past kind of peak oil last year. Peak gas and peak oil are probably not far away. Plus, we've got the ecological consequences of burning all this fossil fuel in terms of climate change. So, I mean, all the infrastructure that's been built up on freely available fossil fuel is,
Definitely very, very much broken. And I'm hoping that the open hardware movement as a whole will be able to take care of that. Like, we have somebody here working on an open source car. he was here last night. We kind of like we have movements. Oh yeah, it's Jaco. We have movements that are working on these problems, and essentially they're related and yet somewhat tangential. So, I completely agree. Peak oil is a problem. Climate change is messed up.